Hi, everyone. This is Pam, and you're listening to the podcast, He Stutters, She Asks Him, which is my occasional podcast with men who stutter. It can be found on the blog Make Room for the Stuttering at stutterrockstar.com. And as always, it's freely available as a download on iTunes. Today, I'm excited to have as a guest a person that's become a good friend and a real expert in the field of stuttering. So, hey, Chris, how are you today?
Hi, Pam. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm really excited that you're a guest with us today. So to get us started, could you formally introduce yourself, who you are, where you're from, what keeps you busy?
Absolutely. My name is Chris Constantino. I'm an assistant professor at Florida State University, where I'm a speech language pathologist by training. I teach the class on stuttering and on counseling, and I research what I'm interested in is how people experience their stuttering and how that is affected by things like how they identify as a person who stutters, their speaking context and stuff like that, with the overall goal to make the stuttering experience as enjoyable as possible. And what keeps me busy is right now I'm on parental leave. So I have a 6-month-old little boy named Augie who keeps me very, very busy.
I'm sure. I liked how you mentioned that you're SLP and you teach on stuttering and counseling. I really like that. I did not know that. And I think it's so important these days for SLPs that work with people who stutter to have that combination of perhaps mechanical fluency enhancing, but also dealing with the complex emotions. So do you teach a full counseling course?
Yeah, we have a dedicated graduate course on counseling. And actually we're in the process of reworking our curriculum. I'm on the faculty curriculum committee, which isn't very exciting, but we're planning a sort of large overhaul of our curriculum, and the plan is to have lab style sessions each semester where these counseling skills can be sort of in addition to having the standalone class, you can have sort of a reinforcement of the skills that they've been learning sort of throughout their time in the program. So hopefully counseling will become a bigger part of the program as time goes on.
So what might that lab experience look like role playing and stuff?
So the idea is that the students would take classes that are blocked based on like a setting they might work in. So a spring semester might have courses that relate to a medical setting. You might take classes on brain injury and on adult language disorders and that kind of thing. And so the lab would be taught by all the teachers teaching in that block of classes, and you'd be workshopping clinical cases. Right. So, whereas in a normal class that's about one disorder, you sort of already know what to do with the patient because you're in a stuttering class or you're in an aphasia class. Chances are, if you're in an aphasia class, your mock client has aphasia, right?
That's right.
But the idea is that you wouldn't really know what's going on with the client. You wouldn't have a prescribed treatment method. You wouldn't have a way of interacting with them ahead of time. It could be anything that you've been studying that semester. And so it would be a lot of case studies and role playing is the plan.
That's great. Was it your idea?
It was a rare example of a committee successfully brainstorming ideas. I was certainly part of the decision-making process, but I wouldn't say it was entirely my idea.
But what a great idea it is. It makes me just rethink and go back to my own therapy experience, which was very limited. I only lasted for about a year and a half. And I was in, a college program where the graduate students were doing the therapy, and it was completely fluency shaping based. And I resisted it from the get go because that's not what I needed. You know, I needed to talk about the feelings and acknowledge that there are complex feelings that go along with stuttering. So, I had to make a choice and I left. And most of the things, because this was 10 years ago, I don't even remember most of the things because that wasn't relevant to me. Right. But if I went to something that you're suggesting where the physical and the emotional were dealt with together, I think that would have made a big difference for me.
I think you sort of put your finger on a big problem that we're seeing in the way speech language pathologists are being trained, is that the scope of practice in the field has expanded so much that the students are really learning to be technicians rather than clinicians. So they have this toolbox that they apply to whatever disorder walks across or walks into their office, and they're not able to adjust when what they're doing isn't working. Mm. Right? They're not able to think critically about the person that's in front of them. What does this person need from me? How can I be of best assistance to them? They just sort of have this, okay, they stutter, this is what I do. And so ideally, even if the clinician you're working with has a preferred method, if they see, like in your case, you know, this isn't what this person needs. This is not helping. We want our clinicians to be able to think on their feet and adjust and not just be robots. So that's sort of the inspiration behind the curriculum change. I don't know if it'll accomplish that goal, but that's what we're hoping for, that the experience you described becomes rarer, mm-hmm. hopefully.
Yeah, and that's why I expressed my delight to hear that you're doing that. And I would also think, based on my not having this, like when you're in a therapeutic relationship, it needs to be mutually goal-driven. And in the situation that I was in, like the SLP was like, you know, she was always a she, knew absolutely more than what I needed than I did. And that's not where I was coming from, having been a social worker and a counselor myself for many years. I'm like, wow, like she's not even asking me what's wrong and why I'm here and what I need. So this approach that you're piloting, if that's a good word, it sounds exciting.
I think it is. Yeah, I think that sort of narrow-minded approach comes from a place of insecurity, mm-hmm. right? Like if I'm a clinician and I only have so many tools in my toolbox, and this is how I've been trained to do therapy, deviating from that could be really scary, right? Because I've never done that. I'm not confident in my clinical abilities. In order to respond to a client in that sort of flexible manner, you have to have a degree of self-confidence in your clinical skills. And I don't know that a lot of our recent graduates have that kind of confidence yet.
Yeah, I definitely agree because, you know, I don't think the graduate students at the time I was in therapy, I don't think they were taking a counseling course. And I don't think that they ever did during their you know, communications disorders program. But in light of all that we know and have learned about stuttering, it certainly is as important, if not more important for so many people who are grappling with their identity as a person who stutters.
Right. I would go as far as to say you could work on the psychological and emotional stuff without ever touching the physical stuff, but you can't work on the physical stuff without also addressing the psychological and the emotional stuff, because they're so intimately tied together.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what drew you in? Why did you decide that you wanted to become a speech language therapist? Because actually I don't like the word pathologist. To me it sounds like medicine, like there's something wrong that you're right. Gonna identify, treat, and fix. So but what drew you in?
So I had speech therapy when I was in high school. I still stutter, but I struggled quite a bit with my stuttering when I was younger. And I had dropped out of therapy when I was in elementary school. Just wasn't, you know, I don't have strong memories of that time. I just remember not really enjoying it. And, because I was in school therapy, you know, I felt like it was making me different from the other kids. And so I told my parents I didn't want to do it anymore, and they said that's fine. And then in high school, I was really having a hard time in my speech, and was convinced by my grandma to go back, give therapy another try. I really didn't want to, but I felt like if grandma was concerned, then I guess it was a big issue. I thought maybe I was fooling everybody and nobody really knew how much I was struggling, but apparently I wasn't. So I went back to therapy, and I don't know if it helped me very much with how I was physically talking. I don't think my fluency changed or my stuttering got much easier, but it was the first time somebody ever told me it was okay to stutter. And we did a lot of like attitudinal work where I would stutter on purpose, and a lot of desensitization work, where I would call places on the telephone and stutter on purpose. And that was really eye-opening for me, that, you know, I could still accomplish things while stuttering, that I didn't have to be fluent to speak. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in high school, so I'm applying to colleges. And I thought, you know, this woman seemed like she had a pretty good gig. She got to help people talk, and it seemed rewarding. And so I wanted to go into speech therapy when I was in high school. However, I still stuttered. I still struggled a lot with my stuttering at the time. And I was worried that I wouldn't be able to be a successful speech therapist. I was really worried people wouldn't trust me. If I was struggling so much with my speech, why would anybody think I can help them with their speech? I thought parents wouldn't trust me with their kid. And so I ended up going into engineering as an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. So I did my undergrad in mechanical engineering, and I sort of reasoned that, you know, you can get a job right out of school as an engineer. You don't have to go to graduate school or anything. I thought, if I like engineering, then I'll be an engineer. If I still want to do speech therapy, that's a grad degree anyway. Mm-hmm. I'll just go to grad school for speech therapy. I ended up going to grad school for speech therapy, I guess I wasn't infatuated with engineering. And I didn't originally intend on getting a PhD. I remember in my interview for my grad program telling them that I never wanted to do research. And then I did a thesis in my grad program and really enjoyed the process of getting to ask and try and answer questions. And so after that, after I graduated, I continued on to get my PhD, and now I guess I'm doing research for a living. I never thought that would happen.
Did you choose engineering because you might have had some vague thought that it wouldn't require as much communication?
I think I did. I mean, I don't think it was like I thought, if I'm an engineer, I don't have to speak. But I think I thought I can be successful at this while speaking like I do. That my ability to do the work will make up for whatever inability I have speaking. So it wasn't like I was trying to hide myself, you know, picking something where I thought I'd do the least amount of talking. I think I thought it would be a job where my stuttering wouldn't get in the way as much as in other jobs.
Well, we're so glad you chose the SLP field, because you have contributed so much, and have helped people look at stuttering through a different lens. And I remember, you know, after meeting you briefly, I remember at some point reading one of the papers that you had written, even before I went to a workshop that I think you did on stuttering gain. And that was like a very foreign title to me, because I had not seen anybody actually, you know, put it out there that there was gain to be had. And then I think you wrote something about what stuttering learns from neurodiversity. Mm-hmm. So what led you in those directions?
I think two things. One was my experiences as a person who stutters, trying to learn how to speak easier. Mm-hmm. And my experience as a therapist, trying to help other stutterers speak easier. Mm-hmm. And the, as a field and as people who stutter, I think we've known for a long time that the less you try not to stutter, the easier speaking is, right? That's almost a truism at this point. But it remains terribly difficult to allow yourself to stutter. And so I was sort of just thinking about this, like, why is this so difficult? Why is this so hard? And I think the way we've been conceptualizing it in speech therapy is that people who stutter have a hard time letting themselves stutter because of some sort of a weakness, right? They're not strong enough, they're embarrassed, they have anxiety. But that didn't seem to convey the whole story to me. It seems like there's obvious reasons why we try not to stutter, right? Since we were children, we're punished for stuttering, whether that's from other kids on the playground, from teachers, from parents, and that punishment doesn't end when we become adults. If anything, it gets worse, because everything's more consequential as an adult, right? If you do poorly in an interview, that's much more important than if somebody bullies you on the playground, right? And so it seemed like a better explanation for why it's so hard for us to let ourselves stutter is that we suffer discrimination, right? We are made to believe that stuttering is bad through all these experiences. And so I felt that it might be easier for us to let ourselves stutter if we could articulate why it was difficult, right? If we could say, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with stuttering, but when I do stutter, here are the consequences that I experience. And that's not my fault, right? That's the experience. That's the fault of how other people view stuttering and how society in general views difference. And so I wanted to think about how do we make it easier for people to let themselves stutter, so that way it's easier to speak. I'm a therapist first and foremost, and so, you know, after me and my clients bumping our heads against the wall forever, you know, how can we think of stuttering in different ways so that it makes it easier to speak? And then once you free stuttering from being necessarily bad, but it's simply something that unfortunately has negative social consequences, then you can start thinking about stuttering as not a pathology, but as just a way that I speak, right? And then once it becomes a way that I speak, obviously, you know, there are things that are frustrating about it, right? Stuttering can be very effortful. It can be exhausting. It can be really hard to express yourself. But most human traits have good and bad. So what are the good things about stuttering? How do we start to articulate, how do we flesh out stuttering so that it's more complicated? And my thinking was that if we can come up with reasons to stutter, then stuttering becomes easier. If we're purposely stuttering, then we're not trying to not stutter.
Right.
Right. And so I thought if I could help my clients and myself articulate reasons to stutter, then likely our stuttering would get easier. Right, that it'd be easier to speak because we're not trying so hard to prevent it,
or censor ourselves.
Right. And I think that's exactly what we're doing. Right, we're only allowing ourselves to speak in certain ways, using certain words under certain circumstances.
Right. So, how did your clients react when you began introducing this different lens to look at and even experience stuttering from?
It was a mixed bag. At the time, I was working in a middle school in Memphis. And I had a lot of stuttering students. I had maybe at that particular year, I think I had around like 10.
Oh, wow.
And most of them were minorities, either African American or, we had a lot of Mexican immigrants. I had some Guatemalan and Honduran students. And so we started talking about it in terms of other identity characteristics, right? So they could very readily express pride in being Black or pride in being Hispanic. And I tried to sort of tie that into, you know, even though there's prejudice, right? Even though sometimes you might experience consequences for being Black or consequences for being Mexican, that doesn't mean that being Black is bad. Right. It doesn't mean that being Hispanic is bad. And they could readily understand that, right? I didn't have to teach them that. They already had that down. Mm-hmm. And then, so then we tried to tie that into their stuttering. And I think some of the kids really got it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it, I think it's still something they were sort of, they had to sort of convince themselves of over and over again, but they, at least they understood it on an intellectual level. Mm-hmm. I think bodily, you know, we have these habits and we react to stuttering in a habitual way, even if our intellectual understanding is different. Right. I think some of my other students were a little bit less convinced. You know, like I said earlier, in addition to the social consequences of stuttering, there's other consequences that are sort of inherent to stuttering, right? The effort it takes to speak, the difficulty in expressing yourself. And race or ethnicity doesn't really have those other negative consequences. So obviously, stuttering is not a perfect analog for that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it has to be. And I think even those students who were resistant to the ideas, I still think it was a worthwhile thought experiment. Mm-hmm. Because it places in their head the idea that, you know, this doesn't have to be black and white, right? Is, I don't mean that in terms of race,
right,
but
right.
It doesn't have to be an either or sort of a thing where this is either good or bad. It could be complicated, right? Mm-hmm. I think my adult clients understand it almost instantly. Mm-hmm. Right? It doesn't necessarily make speaking easier instantly, but the idea that, you know, all the trouble that I've had in my life, maybe that's not entirely my fault, right? Maybe there is some issues of prejudice against difference here. I think most any adults that are can relate to.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Wow. There's a lot of stuff behind what you're doing. Curiously, did you do this with your students in group or in individual sessions?
So all my students in the middle school I saw in groups.
So do you think the group identity and like the group realization helped maybe others who like weren't first buying it, but they saw, you know, their peers like acknowledging like maybe this is okay?
Yeah, I think you have two things that happen. One is good and one is bad.
Oh.
I think that getting to look at how other stutterers are making meaning of their speech can be very, very helpful. Mm. And they can talk about the ideas together. They can work through them together. It's not just an adult telling a child how to think. It's children sort of, you know, working through this on their own. And I think that's the good thing about working in the group. I think when one kid gets it, the other kids want to get it too.
Mm, right.
You know, and they help each other get it. I would say the bad part about it is that if you disagree and everybody in your group agrees, you can feel like the odd man out. You know, I remember one group of students that I had, and I would see them in a group of four. And three of them were pretty, I got them pretty gung-ho about stuttering. You know, they were really trying to embrace it. And one of them just did not want to, right? Mm-hmm. She was stuttering was something bad, and there wasn't anything I can do to tell her different. Mm-hmm. And I could tell that her relationship with the other students was strained by the difference in perspective. She felt less able to share her perspective because the other students would tell her that she was wrong, right? Oh. That she just had to, you know, she just had to think about it differently and everything would be all right. And so I think in some ways the group can be really facilitative, but if you disagree with the group, there's sort of those group dynamics that can ostracize you.
Yeah, and especially, you know, at that age, because peer pressure and fitting in and belonging is so important, irregardless of what, you know, issue you may be working on. And we all have issues, but yeah, you're right. That groupthink and the peer pressure, it's hard for middle school kids.
It's really hard. Middle school kids are you're fun though, because they're so in their own heads that there's something really endearing about their self consciousness. Mm-hmm. They're just a mess. Right, I really like them.
Yeah, and you kind of want to just take them and give them a big hug and reassure them that it will be okay. Because yeah, I worked with middle school kids for a while as part of my career. So yeah, they're messy, but they are also in need of adults that they can trust, that are consistent, that, you know, show up every day or every week. And it sounds like you were a good adult presence for them.
I hope so. They probably don't even remember me, but I hope so.
You know, we never know who, in fact, we make an impact on and who remembers us. We don't know the reach that, you know, our work and our time has on others. So I wouldn't be so quick to say they probably don't remember me. I don't believe that.
That is true. Yeah.
So a lot of your work has led to a wonderful collaboration with a couple of colleagues from the UK, where you guys came together with like ideas, I believe, to edit, author a book. Could you share with us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the book is called Stammering, Pride and Prejudice. And it's a book I edited with Patrick Campbell and Sam Simpson, who are my friends from the UK. Patrick is a pediatrician, and Sam is a speech therapist and a counselor. Mm-hmm. And they actually reached out to me. They had already sort of formed the idea of the book. Sam had been thinking and writing about the social model of disability as it relates to stuttering for decades. And Patrick, I think, was sort of the energy behind getting a book together at this point in time. And so they invited me to be a part of the project. And as the title of the book suggests, the sort of point of it was to document both how stuttering is positioned as something bad by society. So that's the prejudice part, that's not something inherent to stuttering, but that is added onto it by social discourses. Mm-hmm. And also how we might talk about stuttering differently, so that rather than it being something bad, it can be something that we take pride in. So sort of reimaginings of the meanings we make of stuttering.
So you edited it. So was it like, were different chapters written by different people who stutter or have stuttering experience?
Right. So so all the chapters are written by different authors.
Okay.
And we all have chapters in the book, but we also edited the other authors' chapters.
Mm-hmm. And did the book turn out like you guys had envisioned? I mean, did you have to do a million edits, or like, did it conceptualize what it is that you had set out to do?
I think it did. I think we had initially had initially conceived of a book that I think was a bit more structured than the one that we ended up with.
Oh, okay.
So we had planned to have a section of chapters on theory, a section of chapters on prejudice, a section of chapters on pride, and a section of chapters on therapy applications.
Mm-hmm.
And what we ended up with were chapters that sort of touched every aspect of those and weren't easily pigeonholed into the sections of the book. So we ended up not having any sections in the book. It just sort of is one big book. But I think it worked out exactly how we wanted it to. All those things are so intimately tied together that I think we had imposed an artificial structure on it. But I think it worked out just fine.
What kind of feedback have you received from readers?
So far it's been overwhelmingly positive. I'm not on any social media. So
I know you're hard to find.
I all the feedback I have received has come directly to my email. Mm-hmm. And so far it's been very positive. People seem eager to work with these ideas. They seem grateful to have the burden of a lot of their pain taken off of them. Right, and sort of shared broadly mm-hmm. with society. You know, it's not your fault you're having such a hard time. And I think also particularly the chapters that try to think about stuttering in a positive way, mm-hmm. Like you were mentioning from my Stuttering Again article, that's not a way a lot of people are used to thinking about stuttering, and it can be really, really challenging. Mm-hmm. I think even people who have been in stuttering self help and group support for a long time don't think about stuttering as a positive, right? It's something they have to accept, and they've been working on that acceptance, but it's like something you accept and deal with, mm-hmm. right? It's not something you accept and embrace.
Right.
And so to begin to do that hard work of, you know, what, and this is how I always try to ask the question, what experiences do you have because you stutter that you wouldn't have if you were fluent? What good experiences do you have? And I think once we start answering that question and fleshing it out for ourselves, we realize that, you know, just like any other human trait, stuttering isn't entirely bad or good, right? Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. complicated. You have interactions and experiences that you wouldn't have if you were a fluent speaker. That's a fact, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can learn to pay attention to those and flesh those out and add them to our stories that we tell ourselves, I think stuttering becomes easier.
Yeah, yeah. And the subtitle of the book, if that's the right word, I think it says difference, not defect.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think it will take for society to, you know, recognize and adapt to stuttering really being just a difference like other neurodiverse, you know, systems out there?
I think it will take a lot more awareness, right? I mean, I think stuttering people are generally aware that it exists, but most people don't have much more information about it than that. I think one of the reasons why stuttering is so hard a lot of the times is because when you're doing it, people don't realize what you're doing.
Right.
Right. Like, you know, most people don't stutter like Porky Pig. Right. There's no most people don't have a stereotypical stutter. So when you're stuttering, people are looking at you wondering what is it this person is doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think taking some of the mystery away from stuttering, and that just requires more people talking about it, more representation in the media.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, stuttering is common, but it's not that common. Mm-hmm. 1% of the population is quite a chunk of people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like, I don't know, it's still only 1%.
Right.
But I think that's enough that most people come across somebody who stutters in their life. It's not like a condition that you won't run across in your lifetime. So I think better representation in the media, more people talking about it. I think if more people who stuttered, right? If more people stuttered, openly stuttered,
right,
you would hear it a lot more often. And that in of itself would make a change.
Mm.
I also think that because people who stutter have internalized a lot of these messages, right? We have prejudice against ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Boyle has done a lot of research on self-stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we have all that self-stigma, it's going to be really hard to convince other people that this isn't a defect.
Right. We're often the ones that are in our way.
Exactly.
Right.
So I think it's going to take both more hearing more stuttering, seeing more stuttering, but also people who stutter might have to be the catalyst of that change, right? If we can start being more assertive about the fact that, you know, this is how I speak. I think we have to insist that no matter how you stutter, that it's okay.
Mm.
Right? I think even within the stuttering world, we have like shades of acceptable stuttering,
mm-hmm,
right? Where you have like easy stuttering is like the gold
of right
stuttering. And then if you're really effortfully stuttering, then that's a problem. I think no matter how you talk, that has to be okay. And obviously people are welcome to try to learn to speak easier, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a worthwhile thing to do, but you shouldn't be doing it for aesthetic reasons, right? You should be doing it because it makes talking easier. It makes talking less frustrating. But if you're doing it to sound like somebody else, I think that's inherently going to be a frustrating experience because we stutter, so we're not going to sound like fluent people.
Right.
I think as long as people who stutter are compared to fluent people, there's going to be a problem.
Right. And I was just going to say, you know, that you said that, you know, it's going to take more visible and open stuttering, you know, from people who stutter for the world or society to change, you know, to meet us where we're at. But is the onus on us stutterers to solely be responsibility? I mean, have the responsibility for educating?
I don't think it is, right? I think that everybody needs to be more comfortable with disability, right? And I think that's where solidarity with the disabled movement comes in. I think if people who stutter try to do this as just a stuttering movement, it's going to be really hard to get traction with broader society, because we are only 1% of the population. And I don't think it's reasonable to expect people who don't stutter to have read up on stuttering, right? But I think it is reasonable to expect that when people encounter difference, they're not automatically put off by it.
Right.
Right. That when people encounter different ways of speaking, different ways of bodies existing, different ways of minds existing, that it's not automatically seen as negative. And so I think in the stuttering community, we often get into arguments about whether we're disabled, right? And I think a lot of those arguments stem from people's personal journeys with stuttering, that one of their ways of coping has been to keep a stiff upper lip and pretend like everything's all right.
Right.
Right? That I'm not disabled. Every thing is fine. And how I look at it is whether or not you're disabled has nothing to do with how you're coping.
Right.
It has to do with how society sees you.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is that society treats us differently. Right. There's a plethora of my own personal experiences, but also you can look at the research that people who stutter are treated differently. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost not worth arguing about, right? You're disabled if the person you're talking to sees you as disabled.
Right.
Right. Not has nothing to do with how you feel about it. And so I think expecting the public to be more open-minded about disability is where we have to fight that battle.
Yeah, and I also think that people, ourselves, we should lean into the word disability more, because if you don't own it, you're not able to get some of the protections under the ADA in school and at work. So, you know, when they keep the stiff upper lip and no, I'm not disabled, and, you know, they're kind of just like separating themselves from a world of supports that can make a huge difference. So I'm definitely there with you. You know, like, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right?
Right. And I think about this too in terms of ableism. I think one of the reasons why people who stutter don't want to consider themselves disabled is because they're prejudiced against disabled people, right? Like, we have the thing about prejudice is that often everybody has it, right? So just because we're discriminated against doesn't mean that we are free from prejudice against disabled people, right? We have the same prejudices as everybody else. We're part of the same society. So while we're punished for our disability, we don't want to be considered disabled either because of our prejudice against disabled people. It's like it's a hard cycle to break out of.
Yeah, right. Because like if a kid or their parent or their teacher has not, you know, labeled them as disabled, they don't get an IEP and they don't get speech therapy in school. So, and for many children, it is helpful to have speech therapy, yeah, as long as it's the right approached therapy, not I'm going to fix you, you know? Yeah.
Right.
Wow, this has been such a great conversation, and I suspect that we could easily have talked for so much longer. But Chris, it's been a delight to have you on the show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pam. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
And this has been He Stutters, She Asks Him.